Yeah, I'll let you fly it, Django said to Boba. Boba punched a fist into the air in triumph, thrilled that his father was going to let him get behind the controls of Slave One. It had been a long time, months, since Boba had been allowed to sit behind the controls. Not to take her out, though, Django added, somewhat dimming the boy's jubilance. We're going out hot, son, but we'll take her back out of lightspeed early, so you can get some time working her about. Can I put her down? We'll see. Boba knew that his father really meant no, but he didn't press the point. He understood that something big and dangerous was going on here around him, and so he decided to take whatever his dad offered and be happy with that. He hoisted another bag and climbed up the ramp to the small storage hold. He looked back at Django as he did so, then looked past Django, to a human form rushing out of the tower's turbo lift and toward them through the driving rain. Dad, look! As Django swung about, Boba's eyes went wider still. The running figure was their Jedi visitor. And he was drawing his lightsaber and igniting a blue blade that hissed in the downpour. Get on board, Django called to him, but Boba hesitated, watching his father pull out his blaster and fire off a bolt at the charging Jedi. With amazing reflexes, Obi-Wan snapped his lightsaber about, deflecting the bolt harmlessly wide. Boba! Django yelled, and the boy came out of his trance and scrambled up the ramp and into Slave One. Obi-Wan launched himself through the air at the bounty hunter. Another blaster shot followed, then another. And the Jedi easily picked them both off, deflecting one and turning the other back at Django. But as the bolt ricocheted toward him, the bounty hunter leapt away, his rocket pack flaring to life, sending him up to the top of the nearby tower. Obi-Wan tumbled headlong, turning while he rolled to come around as Django fired again. Without even thinking of the movement, letting the Force guide his hand, the Jedi brought his lightsaber to the left and down, knocking the energy bolt aside. You're coming with me, Django, he called. The man answered with a series of shots, a line of bolts coming at the Jedi. The lightsaber went alternately left, then right, picking off each one. And when Django altered the pattern, left, right, then right again, the Force guided Obi-Wan's hand true. Django! He started to call out. But then he realized that the bounty hunter's latest shot was not a bolt, but an explosive pack. And the next moment, he was diving, enhancing his leap with the Force. All of Slave One recoiled from the explosion outside, and the jolt sent Boba tumbling to the side. Dad! He cried. He scrambled to the view screen, flicking it on and orienting the cam on the scene below. He saw his father immediately and burst out in tears of relief. He calmed himself quickly, though, scanning the area for the enemy Jedi, and saw Obi-Wan coming over from a roll back to his feet and blocking another series of bolts with seeming ease. Boba scanned the panel, trying to remember all his lessons about Slave One, glad that he had been so diligent in his studies. With a wicked grin that would have made his father proud, Boba fired up the energy packs and clicked off the locking mechanism of the main laser. Lock this, Jedi, he whispered. He took a bead on Obi-Wan and pulled the trigger. You have a lot to answer, Obi-Wan called to Django, his voice sounding thin in the thunderous downpour and lashing wind. It'll go easier on you and on your son if... He stopped suddenly, registering the report of a heavy laser somewhere in his subconscious. The Force had him moving instinctively before he even understood what was happening, leaping and flying across the air in a double somersault. He landed to find the ground shaking violently under his feet, quaking from the thunder of Slave One's heavy laser cannon, which swung around to follow him. Obi-Wan had to dive again, but this time, the bouncing report sent him sprawling to the ground, his lightsaber skidding from his grasp across the rain-slicking surface. Fortunately, Slave One's cannon went quiet, the energy pack depleted for the moment, and Obi-Wan wasted no time leaping to his feet and charging at Jango Fett, who was coming hard his way. A blaster bolt led the bounty hunter in, but Obi-Wan leapt above the streaking light of energy, flying forward and spinning around to snap kick the weapon from Jango's hand. The bounty hunter didn't flinch. He charged right into the Jedi as Obi-Wan landed, looping his arms over Obi-Wan's and bearing him backward. He tried to wrestle Obi-Wan to the ground, but the Jedi's feet were too quick for that, setting him in perfect balance almost immediately. He slid one leg between the bounty hunter's feet and started to twist to the side, weakening Jango's hold on his arms. Jango smiled wickedly and snapped his forehead into Obi-Wan's face, dazing him for a moment. The bounty hunter pulled a hand free and launched a heavy punch, but realized his mistake immediately as the Jedi ducked the blow and did a tight, stationary somersault right under the swinging arm, double-kicking out as he came over, his feet slamming Jango in the chest and throwing him backward. Now Obi-Wan had gained the initiative, and he used it with a fierce charge, slamming into the stumbling bounty hunter, thinking to bring him down to the ground beneath him, where the encumbering armor the man wore would work against him. But Jango showed the Jedi why he had been chosen as the basis for the clones. He went with the flow of the tackle for a moment, then suddenly reversed his footing and his momentum, stopping Obi-Wan's progress cold. Jango launched a left hook. Obi-Wan ducked and snapped out a straight right in response. Jango slipped his head to the side so that the blow barely grazed him. A short rocket burst had him in the air and spinning a circle kick out at Obi-Wan, who dropped to his knees and ducked it, then came up high in a leap over the second kick as Jango came around again. Now Obi-Wan snapped off a kick of his own, but Jango accepted the blow against his lowered hip and snapped his left arm down across the Jedi's shin, locking the leg long enough for him to drive a right cross into Obi-Wan's inner thigh. The Jedi threw his head and torso back, lying flat out and lifting his left leg as he did, kicking Jango under the side of his ribs. A sudden scissor twist, right leg going down and across, left leg shooting across the other way above it, had Jango and Obi-Wan spinning sidelong. Obi-Wan caught himself with extended arms as he turned face down, broke his feet from their hold on Jango, and mule-kicked the falling man backward. Then, going down to the platform to launch himself right back up to his feet, he turned about and rushed forward, gaining an advantage on the off-balance and struggling Jango. A right cross smashed the bounty hunter across the face, followed by a looping left hook that should have laid the man low. But again, with brilliant reflexes, Jango ducked the brunt of that blow and caught the surprised Obi-Wan with a sudden and short but heavy left and right in the gut. The Jedi's right hand waved across between his face and Jango's, and used a quick force shove to throw the man back a step until he could straighten and find the defensive posture once more. Jango came right back in, fiercely, wildly, kicking and punching with abandon. Obi-Wan's hands worked vertically before him, hardly moving, amazingly precise, turning blow after blow harmlessly aside. He turned one hand in and down suddenly, taking the momentum from a heavy kick, then came right back up to lift Jango's jabbing fist up high. Then he snapped his hand straight out, his stiffened fingers smashing against a seam in the bounty hunter's armor. Jango winced and fell back. Obi-Wan launched himself forward, diving onto the man, going for the victory. But Jango had an answer, firing his rockets and lifting both himself and the grappling Jedi up into the air. A burst of a side thruster sent the pair out past the landing pad proper, to the sloping skirt of the structure. Jango's hands worked almost imperceptibly, twisting in and about the Jedi's arms and hands, expertly loosening Obi-Wan's grip. Then he fired his thrusters left and right, causing a sudden and repeated jerk that broke him free of Obi-Wan's grasp. Obi-Wan hit the deck hard and slid perilously close to the edge, close enough to hear the great waves breaking against the platform's stilts below him. He caught a hold and reached into the Force, using it to grab his lightsaber, recognizing that he was suddenly vulnerable. He heard a shot from the side, not the screech of a blaster bolt, but a sound, and rolled as far as he could. But not far enough. He lost his concentration, along with his grasp on his lightsaber, as a thin wire slid under his wrists, then wrapped about them, securing him tightly. And then he was sliding, back up the sloping skirt and across the platform, towed by the Rocket Man. With reflexes honed by years of intensive training, and with the force strength of a Jedi Master, Obi-Wan snap-rolled his body forward, back up over his outstretched arms, tumbling to his feet, then leaping out to the side as the tow line again went taut, jerking him along. He rolled about a pylon and came back to his feet again, now having the leverage of the metal pole helping to hold him there. Reaching deeply in the force once more, he grounded himself, becoming for an instant almost as one with the platform. Immovable. The wire snapped tightly, but Obi-Wan didn't budge. He felt the angle of the pull change dramatically as the rocket man plunged to the deck, his pack breaking away. Obi-Wan started around the pole, but stopped and shielded his eyes as Jango Fett's rocket pack exploded with a burst of light and a tremendous concussion. "Dad!" Boba Fett cried as the rocket pack blew apart, his face coming right to the view screen. But then he saw Jango off to the side and apparently unharmed, though tugging frantically against the pull of the wire that was now being controlled by the Jedi. Boba slapped one hand helplessly against the screen, mouthing "Dad" again, and then he winced as the Jedi slammed into his father, kicking and butting him, and both of them, locked together, went rolling off the back edge of the landing pad, sliding fast down the skirt and toward the raging ocean. Obi-Wan kicked and tried to find his way back to the Force, but Jango punched him repeatedly. He could hardly believe that the bounty hunter would waste the effort, with certain death awaiting them both at the end of the slide and fall. He managed to pull back somewhat and saw Jango lift one forearm, a strange smile on his face. The bounty hunter clenched his fist, and a line of claws popped forth from the armor. Obi-Wan instinctively recoiled as Jango lifted that arm higher. But then the bounty hunter slammed it down, not on Obi-Wan, but on the platform skirt. At the same time, Jango worked his other hand, releasing the locking mechanism of the wire launching bracelet, and it slid free of his arm. He screeched to a halt, and Obi-Wan slid past him. "Catch a roller fish for me," the Jedi heard Jango say. And then he was falling, over the lip and down toward the raging whitecaps. "Dad! Oh, Dad!" Boba Fett cried in relief as he spotted his father clambering back over the skirt lip and onto the platform. Jango climbed to his feet and stumbled toward Slave One, and Boba rushed to the hatch, sliding it open and reaching down to help his father aboard. "Get us out of here," the dazed and battered Jango said. And Boba grinned and rushed to the control panel, firing up the engines.
"I'll put her right to light speed."
"Just break atmosphere and take her straight out,"
Jango ordered, and his words came out with a growl of pain as he held his bruised side. Then he noticed his son's wounded look.
"Get the nav computer online and have it set the coordinates for the jump," he conceded.
Boba's smile beamed brighter than ever.
"Lift off!" he shouted.
Obi-Wan used the force to grab the trailing loose end of the wire that still held him by the wrists, and he threw that end out, looping it over a crossbeam in the platform structure. His descent stopped with a sudden jerk. He glanced around, then began to swing back and forth, gaining momentum until he was far enough out to pull himself free of the bond and drop lightly onto a small surface platform, barely above the lashing waves. He took only a moment to catch his breath, and then opened the door of the service turbo lift with a wave of his hand. Even before the door opened at the landing platform, he heard the engines of the bounty hunter ship roar to life. He came over the lift, spotting his lightsaber immediately and calling it into him with the force. But he was too late. The ship was already shuddering, ready to blast away. Obi-Wan pulled a small transmitter from his belt and threw it out long and far at Slave One. The magnetic lock of the tracking device grasped on to the ship's hull just in time. Rain and steam pouring all about him, Obi-Wan Kenobi stood there for a long while, until Slave One disappeared from view. He looked around at the platform, replaying the battle in his head, his respect for this bounty hunter, Jango Fett, growing considerably. He understood now why Jango had been selected by Sifo Dyas, or Tyranus, or whoever it was that selected him. The man was good, full of tricks, and full of skill. He had taken Obi-Wan Kenobi, a Jedi Knight, the man who had defeated the Sith Lord Darth Maul, to the very precipice of disaster. But Obi-Wan was still pleased at the way it had played out. He would track Jango now. Perhaps at the end of the coming journey, he would finally get some answers instead of even more riddles. Chapter 19. Boba sat quietly, sensing the tension, as Slave One blasted away from Kamino. He wanted to talk about his shot with the laser cannon, about how he had knocked the Jedi down and sent his lightsaber flying away. But this wasn't the time, he knew, for Jango wore an intense expression that Boba recognized all too well, one that told him clearly that now was not the time for him to speak. The boy rested back against the wall farthest from his father as Jango worked the controls, setting the coordinates for the jump to hyperspace. "Come on, come on," Jango said repeatedly, rocking back and forth, as if urging the ship on, and glancing over at the sensors every few seconds, as if he expected a fleet of starships to be chasing them away. Then he gave a shout of victory and punched the hyperdrive, and Boba went back against the wall, watching the stars elongate. Jango Fett slumped back in his seat and breathed a sigh of relief, his expression softening almost immediately. "Well, that was a bit too close," he said with a laugh. "You smashed him good," Boba replied, his excitement beginning to bubble up again. "He never had a chance against you, Dad." Jango smiled and nodded. "To tell the truth, son, he had me in real trouble there," he admitted. "After he dodged that explosive pack, I'd about run out of tricks." Boba frowned at first, wanting to argue against anyone ever getting the upper hand on his father. But then, as he considered the moment Jango had mentioned, his frown became a wide smile. "I got him good with the laser cannon." "You did great," Jango replied. "You fired at just the right time, and were right there, ready to help me in when it was time for us to go. You're learning well, Boba. Better than I ever believed possible." "That's because I'm a little you," the boy reasoned, but Jango was shaking his head. "You're better than I was at your age, and by a long way. And if you keep working hard, you'll be the best bounty hunter this galaxy's ever seen." "Which was your plan from the beginning with the Kaminoans, right, Dad? That's why you wanted me." Jango Fett moved over and lifted one hand to tousle Boba's hair. "That and a lot of other reasons," he said quietly, reverently. "And in every regard, in every hope and dream, you've done better than I ever expected." There was nothing that anyone in all the galaxy could ever have said to young Boba Fett to make him feel better than those words from his father. Jango took Slave One out of hyperspace a bit early, so that Boba could have some time piloting the ship on the approach to Geonosis. For Boba, sitting in the chair beside his father, working the controls deftly, even showing off a bit, there could be no greater moment. And the boy was saddened by the sight of the red planet, Geonosis, and the asteroid belts that ringed it. "Security's tight here," Jango explained, taking the helm. "It'll be better if I put her down." Boba sat back in the chair without complaint. He knew his father was right, and even if he had disagreed, he wouldn't have done so openly. He turned his attention to the scan screens, showing the composition of the asteroid field nearby, and some distant traffic around the other side of the planet. He noted one blip in particular, disengaging from the asteroid belt and moving out behind Slave One. He didn't think too much of it at first, until a second blip appeared, right behind Slave One, though nothing substantial enough to be a separate ship. "Nearly there, son," Jango remarked. "Dad, I think we're being tracked," Boba told him. "Look at the scan screen. Isn't that a cloaking shadow of our own ship?" Jango looked at him doubtfully, then turned that skeptical expression upon the scan screen. Boba watched with mounting excitement as his father's gaze turned intense and he slowly began to nod. "That Jedi must have put a tracking device on our hull before we left Kamino," he agreed. "But how? I thought he was dead." "Someone's following us," Boba observed.
We'll fix that, Django assured him. Hang on, son. Watch me put us into that asteroid field. He won't be able to follow us there.
He looked over at Boba and winked.
And if he does, we'll leave him a couple of surprises.
Django opened a side panel and pulled a lever, releasing an electric charge along his hull that was designed to destroy just such tracking devices. A quick look at the scan screen showed that the cloaking shadow had disappeared.
Here we go, Django said,
and he dived Slave One into the asteroid field, pulling a fast circuit over and around the nearby rock, then diving out fast to the side, rolling about a spinning boulder and cutting fast between another pair. In and around he wove, with no apparent pattern, and a few moments later, Boba, who was still studying the scanner, announced, "He's gone."
"Maybe he's smarter than I thought, and headed on toward the planet's surface," Django said with a grin and another wink.
Even as he finished, though, the scanner beeped.
"Look, Dad," Boba cried,
pointing out the blip, now inside the asteroid field as well.
"He's back."
"Hang on," Django said,
and he put Slave One through a wild series of dips, climbs, and turns, then finished with a straight-out run, while uncapping a firing trigger and squeezing the plunger.
"Seismic charge," he explained to Boba, who grinned.
But then the boy was screaming a warning as the forward view screen filled up with an asteroid. Django was already on it, turning the amazingly maneuverable Slave One up on its end and running up over the giant space rock.
"Stay calm, son," he assured Boba. "We'll be fine. That Jedi won't be able to follow us through this."
His declaration was accentuated by a sudden flash and a jarring buck as the sonic charge detonated far behind them.
"He got through it,"
Boba cried a moment later, seeing the Jedi ship reappear on the scan screen.
"This guy can't take a hint," said Django, who remained unrattled. "Well, if we can't lose him, we'll have to finish him."
Boba cried out again, but his father was in complete control. He put the ship down a narrow tunnel, creasing one of the larger asteroids. He had to slow a bit to maneuver, and when Slave One came out the other end, Django and Boba saw the Jedi starfighter stream over and past them. The hunted had suddenly become the hunters.
"Get him, Dad!" Boba cried out. "Get him! Fire!"
Laser bolts burst out of Slave One, tracing lines all about the starfighter, which cut a snap roll to the right and down. Django stayed with him, trying to line up another shot, but the Jedi was good, snap rolling one after another, each time coming out near an asteroid and sliding behind it for cover. Boba continued to urge his father on, but Django kept his patience, figuring that sooner or later, the Jedi was going to run out of cover. A fast dive, then a sudden turn back up, then a sudden roll and back to the right had the Jedi moving behind yet another asteroid. But this time, instead of following, Django cut in short of the rock and fired blindly past it. Out came the Jedi starfighter right into the line of fire, and the ship bucked, pieces flying as a laser bolt clipped it.
"You got him!"
Boba yelled in victory.
"And now we just have to finish him," the ever-cool Django explained. "There'll be no more dodging."
He pushed a series of buttons, arming a torpedo and sliding open the tube, then moved to punch the red trigger. He paused, though, and smiled, and nodded for Boba to move closer. Boba could hardly breathe as his father slid his hand onto the smooth trigger grip, then looked down at him and nodded. The boy punched the trigger and Slave One jolted as the torpedo slid away, diving at the Jedi starfighter and taking up the chase as the starfighter bolted and tried to evade. A few brief moments later, Slave One's view screen lit up in the light of a tremendous explosion, forcing Boba and Django to shield their eyes with their arms. When they recovered and looked back, they were greeted by pieces of wreckage and torn chunks of metal. The scan screen was clear.
"Got him!"
Boba shouted.
"Yeah!"
"Nice shot, kid," Django said,
and he tousled Boba's hair again.
"You earned that one. We won't see him again."
A few deft turns had Slave One out of the asteroids and speeding down toward Geonosis, and despite his earlier reasoning, Django Fett allowed Boba to guide the craft down. Truly, this was no flight for a boy to pilot. But Boba Fett was so far above any ordinary boy. Anakin traveled through great canyons of multicolored stone, across dunes of blowing and shifting sand, and along an ancient, long, dry riverbed. His only guide was the sensation of Shmi, of her pain. But it was not a definitive homing beacon, and though he suspected he was moving in the general direction, the landscape of Tatooine was vast and empty, and none knew how to hide among the sand and stones better than the Tusken Raiders. On a high bluff, Anakin paused and scanned the horizon. Off to the south, he noted a huge vehicle, resembling a gigantic tilting box, plodding along on a single huge track. Nodding with recognition of the Jawas, and well aware that no one knew the movements of all creatures among the desert better than they, he kicked his speeder bike away. He caught up to them soon after, riding into a group of the brown and black-robed creatures, their inquisitive red eyes poking out at him from the shadows of huge cowls, their ceaseless chatter humming like strange music all about him. It took him a long time to convince the Jawas that he wasn't interested in purchasing any droids, and a longer time to get them to understand that he was merely looking for information about any Tusken Raiders. The Jawas talked excitedly among themselves, pointing this way and that, hopping all about. Jawas were no friends of Tuskens, who preyed on them, as they preyed on anyone else they found vulnerable. Even worse to the Jawa salesman mentality, Tuskens never purchased any droids. The group eventually came to agreement and pointed as one to the east. With a nod, Anakin sped away. The lack of monetary compensation seemed to aggravate the Jawas, but Anakin had no time to care. The asteroids rolled along their silent way, undisturbed, seemingly unshaken from the explosions and zigzagging vessels. In a deep depression on the backside of one such rock, huddled a small starfighter, its definitive outline and consistent colors showing stark contrast to the rough-edged and bleeding, broken mineral streaks of the asteroid. "Blast! This is why I hate flying," Obi-Wan said to R4, and the droid's responding beeps showed that he was in complete agreement. Few things could rattle the Jedi Knight, but engaging in a space battle with a pilot as obviously skilled as Jango Fett was surely one of them. Unlike many of his Jedi associates, Obi-Wan Kenobi had never much enjoyed space travel, let alone piloting. He winced as his asteroid came over and around, showing him again a glowing piece of torn metal that had taken up orbit within the belt. His ship was wounded from the laser blast. Nothing substantial, just a thruster angler. And he had understood that he could not hope to outmaneuver the clever torpedo. So he had ordered R4 to eject all the spare parts canisters, and fortunately, that had been enough to detonate the missile. Despite the success, between the shock of that blast and landing hard and fast on the asteroid to complete the ruse, Obi-Wan was relieved to see that his ship had remained intact. He wanted no further space fights with Jango and his strange and supremely efficient ship, though. And so he had sat here as the minutes slipped past. "Have you got their last trajectory logged?" he asked the droid. Then nodded as R4 assured him that he did. "Well, I think we've waited long enough. Let's go." Obi-Wan paused for a moment, trying to digest all the amazing things he had seen on the trail of Jango Fett. "This mystery gets more wound up all the time, R4. Think maybe we'll finally get some answers?" R4 gave a sound that Obi-Wan can only think of as a verbal shrug. Following the path taken by Slave One, Obi-Wan was not surprised that it led straight for the red planet, Geonosis. What did surprise him, though, was that they were not alone up there. A series of beeps and whistles from R4 alerted him, and Obi-Wan adjusted his scan screen accordingly, locking onto a huge fleet of vessels settled on the other side of the asteroid belt. "Trade Federation ships," he mused aloud, as he angled to get a better view. "So many?" He shook his head in confusion, noting several of the great battleships among the group. Their unique design made them hard to miss. A sphere, surrounded by a nearly enclosed ring. If the clone army was for the Republic, commissioned by a Jedi Master, and Jango Fett was the basis for the clones, then what ties would Django have to the Trade Federation? And if Django was indeed behind the assassination attempts on Senator Amidala, the leading voice of opposition to creating a Republic Army, then why would the Trade Federation approve? It occurred to Obi-Wan that he might have misjudged Django, or misjudged his motivations at least. Maybe Django, like Obi-Wan and Anakin, had been chasing the bounty hunter who had tried to kill Amidala. Maybe the toxic dart had been fired not to silence the would-be assassin, but as punishment for the attempt on Amidala's life. The Jedi couldn't convince himself of that, though. He still believed that Django was the man behind the assassination attempt, and that he had killed the changeling so that she could not give him up. But why the clone army? And why the Trade Federation ties? There was no apparent logic to it. He knew that he would get no answers up here, so he took a ship down toward Geonosis, keeping the asteroid belt between him and the Trade Federation fleet. He went down low as soon as he broke Geonosis' atmosphere, ducking below any tracking systems that might be in place, skimming the red plains and broken stones, weaving around the buttes and mesas. The whole of the planet seemed a barren and arid red plain, but his scanners did pick up some activity in the distance. Obi-Wan skimmed that way, climbing one mesa and running low to its far end. He slid his ship under a rocky overhang and put her down, then climbed out and walked to the mesa edge. The night air had a curious metallic taste to it, and the temperature was comfortable. A strong breeze blew in Obi-Wan's face, carrying that metallic taste and odor, and the occasional strange cry. "I'll be back, Offal." The droid gave a long... "You'll be fine," Obi-Wan assured him. "And I won't be long." Glad to be back on the ground once again, Obi-Wan checked his bearings, measured against the area where he had noted the activity, and started off, moving along a rocky trail. The hours were unbearable for Padme. Owen and Beru were friendly enough, and Cleek was obviously glad for the added company in his time of great concern and profound grief. But she could hardly speak to them, so worried was she for Anakin. She had never seen him in a mood like the one that had taken him from the moisture farm. His determination so palpable, so consuming, that it seemed almost destructive. She had felt Anakin's power in that parting, an inner strength beyond anything she had ever known. If his mother was indeed alive, and she believed that Shmi was, since Anakin had said so, Padme knew that no army would be strong enough to keep the young Jedi from her. She didn't sleep that night, rising often from her bed and pacing all about the compound. She wandered into the garage area, alone with her thoughts. Or so she believed.
"Hello, Miss Padme,"
came a chipper voice. And as soon as Padme got over the initial shock, she recognized the speaker.
"You can't sleep?"
C-3PO asked. "No, I have too many things on my mind, I guess."
"Are you worried about your work in the Senate?"
"No, I'm just concerned about Anakin. I said things. I'm afraid I might have hurt him. I don't know. Maybe I only hurt myself. For the first time in my life, I'm confused."
"I'm not sure it will make you feel any better, Miss Padme. But I don't think there's been a time in my life when I haven't been confused."
"I want him to know that I care about him, 3PO," Padme said quietly. "I do care about him. And now he's out there and in danger."
"Don't worry about Master Annie," the droid assured her, moving over to pat her shoulder. "He can take care of himself, even in this awful place."
"Awful?" Padme asked. "You're not happy here?" C-3PO stepped back and held his hands out wide, showing his battered coverings and the chipped insulation in those areas where some of his wiring showed. Padme moved forward, bending to see, and noticed sand clinging in many of the droid's joints.
"Well, this is a very harsh environment, I'm afraid," the droid explained. "And when Master Ani made me, he never quite found the time to give me any outer coverings. Mistress Shmi did well in finishing me, but even with the coverings, the wind and the sand are quite harsh. It gets in under my coverings, and it's quite itchy."
"Itchy," Padme echoed with a laugh, a much-needed laugh.
I do not know how else to describe it, Miss Padme. And I fear that the sand is doing damage to my wiring.
Padme looked all around, her gaze settling on a chain hoist over an open tub of dark liquid. You need an oil bath, she said.
Oh, I would welcome a bath.
Glad for the distraction, Padme moved to the oil tub and began sorting out the hoist chain. In a short while, she had C-3PO secured and everything in place, and she gently lowered the droid into the oil.
Ooh,
the droid cried.
That tickles.
Tickles? You're sure it's not an itch?
I do know the difference between a tickle and an itch, C-3PO
answered. Padme giggled and forgot for a while all of her troubles. As soon as he came upon the grisly scene, Anakin knew that it was the work of Tuskens. Three farmers, likely some of those whom Kleeg had been with before being forced to return home, lay dead about a campfire, their bodies battered and torn. A pair of Eopes, long-legged dromedaries with big padded feet and equine faces that showed little intelligence, stood tethered nearby, lowing mournfully, and beyond them hung the smoking remains of a speeder. Anakin ran his fingers through his hair. Calm down, he told himself. Find her. He fell within himself then, within the Force, and sent his senses out far and wide, needing the confirmation that his mother had not yet met a similar fate. A stab of pain assaulted him, and a cry that was both hopeful and helpless entered his mind. Mom, he mouthed breathlessly, and he knew that time was running out, that Shmi was in terrible pain and was barely holding on. He didn't have the time to bury the poor farmers, but he did resolve to come back for them. He jumped astride the speeder bike and put it flat out, rushing across the dark desert landscape, following Shmi's call. The trail was narrow and steep, but at least Obi-Wan was back on solid footing. Or almost solid, he realized. As a shrill shriek split the air, startling him, his foot slipped. He nearly tumbled but caught his balance, as a bunch of stones fell loose, bouncing down the side of the mesa. The Jedi drew out his lightsaber, but did not ignite it. He moved along cautiously, down and around a bend in the rocky path. He saw the large lizard-like creature coming for him, its huge fangs dripping lines of drool. It stood on strong hind legs, its little forelegs twitching eagerly. The lightsaber hummed to life, and Obi-Wan dived down to the side, slashing back as he fell, opening the creature's side from foreleg to hind. The creature landed and tried to turn, but as it spasmed in pain, it overbalanced and fell off the trail, plummeting hundreds of feet and shrieking all the way. Obi-Wan had no time to watch the descent, though, for another of the beasts appeared, coming at him fast, its toothy maw open wide. The Jedi filled that maw with lightsaber, shearing through teeth and gums, driving the blade right through the back of the creature's head. He pulled hard to the side, the energy blade tearing right through the beast's skull, and turned to face yet another leaping beast. Falling back and down, he let the lizard fly past. Then he came up immediately and started to pursue. But abruptly he stopped, reversed his grip, and stabbed out behind him, impaling a fourth creature. He spun about, flipping the weapon from his right hand to his left, then slashed it out the side of the dying beast. As he completed his circuit, coming right around to face the one that had leapt past. The creature circled slowly, seemingly sizing him up, and Obi-Wan turned with it, but kept his eyes and ears scanning the area. He tried to scare the creature off, and with two of its companions lying dead on the rocks, and a third having gone over the cliff, he fully expected it to flee. But not this fierce beast. It charged suddenly, jaws snapping. A sidestep, forward step, and overhand slash had the creature's head rolling free on the ground. Fun place, The Jedi remarked after a while, when he was confident that no more of the creatures were about. He put his weapon away and moved along, and soon after rounded the corner of the mesa. A great plain spread out wide before him, with many tall shapes in the far distance, indistinguishable in the darkness. Obi-Wan took out his electro-binoculars and peered across the plain. He saw a cluster of great towers, not natural stalagmites like those he had seen dotting the landscape, but shaped structures. A roll of his finger increased the magnification of both size and available light, and he scanned slowly to the side. Trade Federation starships, scores of them, lined the region, settled on platforms. The Jedi watched in amazement as another platform rose beside one ship, and thousands of battle droids stepped off it and into the vessel, which then lifted away, and was quickly replaced by another starship, settling down on the platform. Another platform rose to the side, and again, thousands of droids stepped off to board the waiting starship, and that one, now filled with droid soldiers, lifted away. "Unbelievable," the Jedi muttered, and he looked to the eastern horizon, trying to gauge the amount of time he had before dawn, wondering if he could make the run before the light found him. Not if he had to slowly work his way down the mesa, he realized, and so he shrugged and stepped ahead, closing his eyes and finding his power in the Force. Then he leapt out, lifting himself with the Force to ease his descent. He hit a bluff many feet down, but sprang away and fell again and again, half bouncing, half flying his way down to the dark plain. The sun was still below the eastern rim, though the land was beginning to lighten around him, when he reached the grandest tower of the complex. The entryway was heavily guarded by battle droids, but Obi-Wan had no intention of going anywhere near that area. Using the Force and his own conditioning, the Jedi scaled the tower until he came to a small window. He slipped in silently and moved from shadow to shadow, then ducked behind a wind curtain as he heard the approach of a pair of strange-looking creatures. Geonosians, he supposed. They wore little clothing, and their skin was reddish, like the air about them, with flaps hanging in rolls in many places about their slender frames. Leathery wings showed behind their bony shoulders. Their heads were large and elongated, their skulls ridged top and side, and they had thick-lidded bulbous eyes. Their expression seemed to be locked in a perpetual scowl.
"Too many sentients," he heard one of them say.
"It is not your place to question Archduke Poggle the Lesser," the other scolded. And grumbling, the pair wandered away. Obi-Wan moved out behind them, going the opposite way.
He slipped from shadow to shadow along a narrow corridor lined with pillars. He couldn't help but see the contrast between this place and Topoka City. Where Topoka City was a work of art, all rounded and smooth, all glass and light, this place was rough-edged, all sharp corners and utilitarian features. The Jedi moved along, coming to an open vent, sharp noises and pounding echoing up from it. He dropped to the ground and looked all about, then crawled and peered over the edge. A factory, a huge alignment of conveyor belts and pounding machines, lay below in a wide-open area. Obi-Wan watched in blank amazement as many, many Geonosians, these without wings like the pair that had walked past him, worked at various stations assembling droids. At the far end of the conveyor, completed droids stepped off under their own power, walking away down a distant corridor, to platforms that would lift them to waiting Trade Federation starships, the Jedi realized. With a shake of his head, Obi-Wan ran along, and then he sensed something, fleeting but definite. He followed his instincts along the maze of corridors, at last coming to a vast underground chamber with huge vaulted ceilings and rough-styled arches. He started across, moving pillar to pillar, sensing that something or someone was near. He heard their voices before he saw them, and he fell flat against a stone. A group of six figures walked past him, four in front and two behind. Two Geonosians were in that front row, along with a Nemoidian viceroy, whom Obi-Wan knew all too well, and a man whose features were also recognizable from busts the Jedi had seen in the temple on Coruscant.
"Now we must persuade the Commerce Guild and the Corporate Alliance to sign the treaty," that former Jedi, Count Dooku, was saying. The man was tall and regal, with perfect posture and a graceful gait. His hair was silver and perfectly trimmed, and his elegant features, strong jaw, and piercing eyes completed the look of a man who had once been among the greatest of the Jedi. He wore a black cape, clipped at his neck by a silver chain, and a black shirt and pants of the finest materials. In looking at him, in feeling his presence, Obi-Wan understood that nothing less would ever suit this one.
"What about the senator from Naboo?"
asked the Nemoidian, Newt Gunray, his beady eyes and thin features seeming smaller still beneath the tri-pronged headdress he always wore.
"Is she dead yet? I'm not signing your treaty until I have her head on my desk."
Obi-Wan nodded, huge pieces of the puzzle starting to fall into place. It made sense to him that Newt Gunray would want Amidala dead, even if her voice of opposition to an army of the Republic was working in his favor. Amidala had embarrassed the Nemoidian badly in the Battle of Naboo, after all.
"I am a man of my word, Viceroy," one of the Separatists answered.
"With these new battle droids we've built for you, Viceroy, you'll have the finest army in the galaxy," said the Geonosian,
whom Obi-Wan believed to be Poggle the Lesser. He didn't look much like the winged commoners and workers Obi-Wan had seen. His skin was lighter, more a grayish tan than red-tinted, and his head was huge, his large, scowling mouth protruding just a bit, giving him a fierce appearance, an elongated chin that seemed more a long beard hung halfway down his torso. They continued their banter, but had moved out of earshot by then, and Obi-Wan didn't dare step out to follow. They moved across the way, through an archway and up a flight of stairs. After a short pause to make sure they were well along, Obi-Wan rushed out, peeking through to the stairs, then crept up them, coming to a narrow archway overlooking a smaller room. Inside, he saw the six who had passed, along with several others, notably three opposition senators the Jedi recognized. First came Poe Nudo of Ando, an Aqualish, who looked as if he was wearing a helmet with great goggles, but was not, of course. Beside him sat Necklace Tunbuktura of Sea Mirth, with her rodent-like head and wide mouth, and the Quarren Senator Tesek, his face tentacles waggling anxiously. Obi-Wan had met this trio before, back on Coruscant. Yes, he realized. It seemed he had walked into the center of the Hive.
"You have met Shu Mai?"
Count Dooku, seated at the head of the table, asked the three senators.
"Representing the Commerce Guild."
Across the way, Shu Mai nodded deferentially. Her delicate and gray wrinkled head was set on a long neck, and her most striking feature, aside from long and pointy horizontal ears, was a hairstyle that looked much like a skin-covered horn protruding out the back of her skull, rising up and curving forward.
"And this is San Hill, distinguished member of the Intergalactic Banking Clan," Dooku went on, indicating a creature with the longest and narrowest face Obi-Wan had ever seen.
Those gathered about the table murmured their greetings, nodded to each other for many moments, and then they went silent, all eyes settling on Count Dooku, who seemed to Obi-Wan in complete control here, even above the Archduke of the planet.
"As I explained to you earlier, I'm quite convinced that 10,000 more systems will rally to our cause with your support," the Count said.
And let me remind you of our absolute commitment to capitalism, to the lower taxes, the reduced tariffs, and the eventual abolition of all trade barriers. Signing this treaty will bring you profits beyond your wildest imagination. What we are proposing is complete free trade.
He looked to Newt Gunray, who nodded.
Our friends in the Trade Federation have pledged their support, Count Dooku went on. When their battle droids are combined with yours, we shall have an army greater than anything in the galaxy. The Republic will be overwhelmed.
If I may, Count, said one of the others,
one of the two who had trailed Dooku to the room.
Yes, Passel Argenti, Count Dooku said. We are always interested in hearing from the Corporate Alliance.
The huddled and nervous man offered a slight bow to Dooku.
I am authorized by the Corporate Alliance to sign the treaty.
We are most grateful for your cooperation, Magistrate, Dooku said.
Obi-Wan recognized that exchange for what it was. A play for the benefit of the other less enthusiastic people at the table. Count Dooku was trying to build some momentum. That momentum hit a bit of a bump a moment later, though, when Shumai piped in.
The Commerce Guild at this time does not wish to become openly involved.
However, she smoothed it over immediately.
But we shall support you, in secret, and look forward to doing business with you.
Several chuckles erupted about the table, and Count Dooku only smiled.
That is all we ask, he assured Shumai.
Then he looked to the distinguished member of the banking clan, and all the other gazes settled on Sandhill as well.
The intergalactic banking clan will support you wholeheartedly, Count Dooku, Sandhill declared, but only in a non-exclusive arrangement.
Obi-Wan settled back, trying to sort out the implications of it all. Count Dooku had it all falling together here, a threat beyond anything the Republic had expected. With the money of the bankers and the commercial and trade guilds behind him, and this factory, and likely many others like it, churning out armies of battle droids, the potential danger was staggering. Was that why Sifo Dyas had commissioned the clone army? Had the Master sensed this growing danger, perhaps? But if that was true, then what was the tie between Jango Fett and this group on Geonosis? Was it mere coincidence that the man chosen as source for the clone army to defend the Republic had been hired by the Trade Federation to kill Senator Amidala? It seemed too much a coincidence to Obi-Wan, but he had little else to go on. He wanted to hang around and listen in some more, but he knew then that he had to get out of there. Had to return to his ship in R4 and get a warning out across the galaxy to the Jedi Council. Over the last hours, Obi-Wan had seen nothing but armies, clone and droid, and he knew that it would all be coming together very quickly in an explosion beyond anything the galaxy had seen in many, many centuries. Chapter 20. She wasn't seeing much with her eyes. Caked with blood and swollen from the beatings, they would hardly open. She wasn't hearing much with her ears, for the sounds around her were harsh and threatening, relentlessly so. And she wasn't feeling with her body, for there was nothing there but pain. No, Shmi had fallen inside herself, reliving those moments long ago when she and Anakin had lived their lives as Watto's slaves. It was not an easy life, but she had her Annie with her, and given that, Shmi could remember those times fondly. Only now, with the prospects for ever seeing her son again so distant, did she truly appreciate how much she had missed the boy over the last 10 years. All those times staring up at the night sky, she had thought of him. had imagined him soaring across the galaxy, rescuing the downtrodden, saving planets from ravaging monsters and evil tyrants. But she had always expected to see her Annie again, had always expected him to walk onto the moisture farm one day. That impish smile of his, the one that could light up a room, greeting her as if they had never been apart. Shmi had loved Klieg and Owen, truly she had. Klieg was her rescuer, her dashing knight. And Owen had been like the son she had lost, always compassionate, always happy to listen to her endless stories of Anakin's exploits. And Shmi was growing to love Beru, too. Who could not? Beru was that special combination of compassion and quiet inner strength. But despite the good fortune that had brought those three into her life, improving her lot a millionfold, Shmi Skywalker had always kept a special place in her heart, reserved for her Annie, her son, her hero. And so now, as it seemed the end of her life was imminent, Shmi's thoughts focused on those memories she had of Anakin, while at the same time, she reached out to him with her heart. He was always different with such feelings, always so attuned to that mysterious force. The Jedi who had come to Tatooine had seen it in him clearly. Perhaps then Annie would feel her love for him now. She needed that, needed to complete the cycle, to let her son recognize that through it all, through the missing years and the great distances between them, she had loved him unconditionally and had thought of him constantly. Annie was her comfort, her place to hide from the pain the Tuskens had and were exacting upon her battered body. Every day, they came in and tortured her a bit more, prodding her with sharp spears or beating her with the blunt shafts and the short whips. It was more than a desire to inflict pain, Shmi realized, though she didn't speak their croaking language. This was the Tusken way of measuring their enemies, and from the nods and the tone of their voices, she realized that her resilience had impressed them. They didn't know that her resilience was wrought of a mother's love. Without the memories of Annie, and the hope that he would feel her love for him, she would surely have given up long ago and allowed herself to die. Under the pale light of a full moon, Anakin Skywalker pulled the speeder bike to the ridge of a high dune and peered across the desert wastes of Tatooine. Not too far below him, he saw an encampment spread about a small oasis, and he knew at once, even before spotting a figure, that it was a Tusken camp. He could sense his mother down there, could feel her pain. He crept closer, studying the straw and skin huts for any anomalies that might clue him in to their respective purposes. One especially sturdy hut, at the edge of the oasis, caught and held his attention. It seemed less tended than the others, yet more solidly constructed. As he came around a bit more, he grew even more intrigued, noting that only one hut was guarded by a pair of Tuskens flanking the entrance. "Oh, Mom," Anakin whispered. Silent as a shadow, the Padawan slipped through the encampment, moving hut to hut, flat against walls, and belly crawling across open spaces, working his way gradually toward the hut he felt held his mother. He came against its side at last and put his hands against the soft skin wall, feeling the emotions and pain of the person within. A quick glance around the front showed him the two Tusken guards, sitting a short distance in front of the door. Anakin drew and ignited his lightsaber, then crouched low, shielding the glow as much as he could. He slid the energy blade through the wall and easily cut the material away. Then, without even pausing to see if any Tuskens were inside, he crawled through. "Mom," he breathed again, and his legs weakened beneath him. The room was lit by dozens of candles and by a shaft of pale moonlight streaming through a hole in the roof, illuminating the figure of Shmi, tied, facing against a rack to the side of the tent. Her arms were outstretched, bound at bloodied wrists, and her face, when she turned to the side, showed the weeks of beatings. Anakin quickly cut her free and gently lowered her from the perch, into his arms, and then down to the floor. "Mom. Mom. Mom." he whispered softly. Anakin knew that she was alive, though she did not immediately respond and had come down so pitifully limp. He could feel her in the Force, though she was a thin, thin sensation. He cradled her head and kept repeating her name softly, and finally, Shmi's eyelids fluttered open, as much as she could manage through the swelling and dried blood.
Annie,
she whispered back. He could feel her wheezing as she tried to speak, and knew that many of her ribs had been crushed.
Annie, is it you?
Gradually, her eyes began to focus upon him, and he could see a thin smile of recognition coming to her battered face. I'm here, Mom, he told her. You're safe now. Hang on. I'm going to get you out of here.
Annie. Annie?
Shmi replied, and she tilted her head, the way she often had when Anakin was a boy, seeming quite amused by him.
You look so handsome.
Save your strength, Mom, he said, trying to calm her. We've got to get away from here.
My son, Shmi went on,
and she seemed to be in a different place than Anakin, a safer place.
My grown-up son. I knew you'd come back to me. I knew it all along.
Anakin tried again to tell her to lie still and save her strength, but the words simply wouldn't come out of his mouth.
I'm so proud of you, Annie. So proud. I missed you so much.
I missed you too, Mom, but we can talk later.
Now I am complete,
Shmi announced then, and she looked straight up, past Anakin, past the hole in the ceiling, to the shining moon, it seemed. Somewhere deep inside, Anakin understood. Just stay with me, Mom, he pleaded, and he had to work very hard to keep the desperation out of his voice. I'm going to make you well again. Everything's going to be fine.
I love,
Shmi started to say, but then she went very still, and Anakin saw the light leave her eyes. Anakin could hardly draw his breath. Wide-eyed with disbelief, he lifted Shmi to his breast and rocked her there for a long time.
She couldn't be gone. She just couldn't.
He pulled her back again, staring into her eyes, silently pleading with her to answer him. But there was no light there, no flicker of life. He hugged her close, rocking her. Then he laid her back to the floor and gently closed her eyes. Anakin didn't know what to do. He sat motionless, staring at his dead mother, then looked up, his blue eyes blazing with hatred and rage. He replayed all of the recent events of his life in his head, wondering what he might have done differently, done better to keep Shmi alive. He should never have left her here in the first place, he realized. Should never have let Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan take him away from Tatooine without bringing his mother along as well. She said she was proud of him, but how could he deserve her pride if he could not even save her? He wanted Shmi to be proud of him, wanted to tell his mom all about the things that had come into his life, his Jedi training, all the good work he had already done, and most of all, about Padme. Oh, how he wanted his mom to get to know Padme. She would have loved her. How could she not? And Padme would have loved her. Now, what was he going to do? The minutes slipped past, and Anakin just sat there, immobilized by his confusion, by a budding rage, and the most profound sense of emptiness he had ever known. Only when the pale light began to grow around him, making the low-burning candle seem even thinner, did he even remember where he was. He looked about, wondering how he might get his mother's body out of there, for he certainly wasn't going to leave it to the Tusken Raiders. He could hardly move, though. There seemed a profound pointlessness to it all, a series of motions without meaning. At that time, the only meaning, The only purpose that Anakin could fathom was that of the rage building within him, an anger at losing someone he did not wish to give up. Some small part of him warned him not to give in to that anger, warned him that such emotions were of the dark side. Then he looked at Shmi lying there so still, seeming at peace but covered with the clear evidence of all the pain that had been inflicted upon her poor body these last days. The Jedi Padawan climbed to his feet and took up his lightsaber, then boldly strode through the door. The two Tusken guards gave a yelp and lifted their staves, rushing for him. But the blue glowing blade ignited, and in a flash of killing light, Anakin took them down, left and right. The rage was not sated. Deep in his meditations, peering through the dark side, Master Yoda felt a sudden surge of anger, of outrage beyond control. The diminutive master's eyes popped open wide at the overwhelming strength of that rage. And then he heard a voice, a familiar voice, crying,
"No! No, Anakin! No! Don't! No!"
It was Qui-Gon. Yoda knew that it was Qui-Gon, but Qui-Gon was dead, had become one with the Force. One could not retain consciousness and sense of self in that state. One could not speak from beyond the grave. But Yoda had heard the ghostly call, and in his deep meditative state, his thoughts focused as precisely as they had ever been, the Jedi Master knew that he had not been mistaken. He wanted to focus on that then, perhaps to try to follow that call back to the ghostly source, but he could not, overwhelmed again by the surge of rage and pain and power. He made a noise and lurched forward, then came out of his trance, as his door opened and Mace Windu rushed in.
"What is it?" Mace asked.
"Pain. Suffering. Death. I fear something terrible has happened. Young Skywalker is in pain. Terrible pain."
He didn't tell Mace the rest of it. That somehow Anakin's rush of agony manifesting in the Force had tapped into the spirit of the dead Jedi Master who had discovered him. Too much was happening here. That disembodied familiar voice hung profoundly in Yoda's thoughts. For if it was true, if he had heard what he was sure he had heard... Anakin, too, had heard the voice of Qui-Gon, imploring him to restrain himself, to deny the rage. He hadn't recognized it, though, for he was too full of pain and rage. He spotted a Tusken woman to the side, in front of another of the tents, carrying a pail of dirty water, and saw a Tusken child in the shadows of another nearby hut, staring at him with an incredulous expression. Then he was moving, though he was hardly aware of his actions. His blade flashed and he ran on. The Tusken woman screamed and was impaled. Now all the camp seemed in motion, Tuskens rushing out of every hut, many with weapons in hand. But Anakin was into the dance of death then, into the energy of the Force. He leapt far and long, clearing one hut and coming down before another, his blade flashing even before he landed, even before the two Tuskens recognized that he had jumped between them. A third came at him, thrusting forth a spear, but Anakin lifted an empty hand and set up a wall of Force energy, as solid as stone. Then he shoved out with that hand, and the Tusken spearmen flew away, fully 30 meters, smashing through the wall of yet another hut. Anakin was often running, often leaping, his blade spinning left and right in a blur, every stab taking a Tusken down, writhing to the ground, every slash putting a piece of a Tusken on the ground. Soon, none were standing against him, all trying to flee, but Anakin